Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, an all-new 55-year-old episode. The great radio storyteller Gene Shepherd tells a comic tale of his childhood, The Great Hamburger Blow-Up. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we take another brief vacation from our usual tone of gloom, doom, and corporate oppression. We have instead a really nice tale by radio's comic satirist and storyteller nonpareil, Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd is best known as the host of a late-night radio program. It went for 45 minutes each weeknight on station WOR AM and FM in New York. He flourished in the late 1950s and throughout the 60s. Many people today know him as the guy who wrote the script for the 1983 film A Christmas Story, which was based on Shepherd's own childhood experiences. I never saw the film, but I did catch a few of his radio broadcasts back in the 1960s. AM reception happened to be extra good that night in my hometown outside of Philadelphia. I was scanning about with my bedroom AM radio when I should have been sleeping. And then and there I discovered this voice telling a story, seemingly ad lib. The speaker was hip and funny and ironic and satiric. The voice wove a web, and I just wanted to stay and hear more. Hip irony is easy to find on the air today. Think of This American Life and, of recent memory, News from Lake Wobegon and Car Talk and, best of all, a fine Canadian program called The Vinyl Cafe. But Gene Shepherd was the first of the lot. He seems to have invented the genre. Three times in the past, I have labored mightily to find a juicy 45-minute Gene Shepherd show and somehow trim it down to 25 minutes to fit on our program. Never one to admit defeat, I do so again today. Today we'll hear one of Shepherd's occasional sweet and comic stories of his own childhood, plus a good deal of his clowning around, commercials that are half read from the script and half wildly improvised, and miscellaneous barbed comments on American life. Today's monologue is known as The Great Hamburger Blow-Up. It was broadcast on April 1, 1965. Here is radio great Gene Shepherd.
Oh, boy, I can't even go on to tell you this story. I'm just a kid. Of course, when you're a kid, you're just like a peeled grape. You're standing there with the little seeds there inside of you, you know, the sun shines down on you, and you think everything is hotsy-totsy and hunky-dory, and yet you always suspect these are schimmel thinking. Sorry. You always suspect that there is an evil dragon hiding in the bushes, you know? But then, on the other hand, you can't believe that there is. It just can't. I got to get this thing in tune. I can tell you this. Listen. Don't you laugh. Don't you laugh. There are stories that I could tell you. One. There are stories I could tell you would curl your hair. And these would just be stories out of real life. The things we've all lived through. The sniffing, rotten, grabbing, screaming stories deep down in the undergrowth of life and existence. When the socks are twisting in your tennis shoes. Yes, and the fetid heat of life itself is steaming out of your ears like some cold, cool wind of the August of eternity. Oh, we could all tell these stories, no question about it. It just remains for the artist in society to be the one klutz who gets up on a Campbell's pork and bean box and says, I'll say it for all of us. I'm on a swell level for each one of you. Now, if you promise not to say too much about it, you know, when a guy walks around, he gets grown up, you know, you're big grown up people, and you own a $40 suit, and, you know, you're all grown up, and you got a pair of shoes, the tie and everything, and you walk around, and you've got a couple of credit cards in your pocket. It's easy to pretend that you have never been shot down. You know, in flames, I'll tell you that terrible moment, you know. Isn't it funny whenever a kid reads stories, he reads stories about aerial combat? When I was a kid, I used to always read stories about aces, you know, who flew airplanes, and they fought against the dreaded checkernose circus of Baron von Richthofen. And they were always involved in these fantastic dogfights. And I can remember these pilots. They always the pros ran something like this. He bit into a tight chandelle and then felt the thrumming of the Spandau bullets, the slugs, ripping their way through his fuselage closer and closer to his camelback. He pulled back the stick. Up he went, higher and higher and higher, the wind screaming through his struts, and now he was on the tail of the dreaded Baron himself. He paused. Well, you know, we're always winning in these stories. Always winning. We never see ourselves being shot down. Trailing smoke and outlined and etched against the sun. Well, I think tonight I might as well tell the story about the time I was shot down. And I mean shot down. Oh, boy. Speaking of obscenity, this is AM and FM New York. Oh, and boy, lucky we're not on the air. Holy smokes. Tell the story. You can see that I just don't want to tell this story because it's a very unpleasant story. And I might as well warn those of you out there who are not prepared to accept life in the raw, or as George Ade used to say, life as she is. I'm giving you a little skull and crossbones now, right at this moment. This program is not for women and kids. That's our disclaimer here. And, oh, by the way, this program does not represent the views of the management here at the radio station who hates Shepard. He's got a drag with somebody higher than us. We'd like to know who it is. That's why he's on the fink. Okay. This is a fine automobile, and if you'd like to get pictures of it and little whoopies that you can hang up on your wall, send your name and address to Peugeot. And by the way, they're not going to use it as a customer list or anything like that, so don't worry about it. Send your name and address to Peugeot, P-O-O-J-O-E, Peugeot, in care of me, Friendly Fred, here at WOR, and I'll see to it that 3 months will go by before you get it. That's Peugeot. And their dealer here is at 2 East 46th Street, right in the heart of the fantastically overpriced rent district. Are you a great reader of boxes, of labels? Do you ever read the back of Wheaties packages when you're sitting there, when you're insane? I'm committing the sin of admitting a weakness here, but I'm a compulsive reader. I have to have something to read all the time. Now, that is moments, you know, like when you're eating or something like that, or you're walking around, you have a second between things and you read. I always carry a book with me, but sometimes I'm caught without it. And I am a genuine reader of junk and stuff. And I ran across a thing, and I wrote it down here. I just had to bring it with me. And in passing, I thought I'd just mention this in passing, but it was one of the great labels that I've read in a long time. And it was on, of all things, I'm in a supermarket. And I'm walking around, you know, looking at stuff in the supermarket, paying very little attention. And I came to this, the little Crudley's department, you know, a little department where they sell things like olive picks, plastic olive picks, you know, and stuff like that. Little doilies to put underneath your martinis. You know, the little junk department. and it was in the toothpick division of the junk department. Are you aware that there is a World's Fair toothpick? There's an official World's Fair toothpick? Somehow, you know, the World's Fair started out with such great ideas, peace through understanding and all that jazz, tremendous generalities about man's condition, and they wind up by producing a World's Fair toothpick. And I why is it called a World's Fair toothpick? And what makes a World's Fair toothpick better and different from other World's Fair toothpicks? Here is the description of a World's Fair toothpick read to you directly off the box. Can I have a little dramatic music, please, behind this? That's very good. World's Fair round toothpicks are pointed by gradual tapering from center to ends, which allow more of the toothpick to pass between the teeth, facilitating gum massage as well as removing food particles. These are official World's Fair round toothpicks. Can you imagine the scene? Somewhere, someplace, a copywriter writing deathless prose to be found on a package of World's Fair round toothpicks. He sits there for a moment, then he says, I've got it, Chief! I've got it! What makes our toothpick different and better than all the toothpicks? What do you mean they're the same? No, they're not the same. They'll not be the same when I finish writing about World's Fair round toothpicks. Now, how do they look, boss? Think about it for a minute. Are ours flat toothpicks? Are ours skinny toothpicks? Are ours short, fat, blunty toothpicks? No, Chief. They're gradually tapered from end to end. From the middle to each end, gradually tapered, allowing one to massage the gums, to remove particles of food with both ends. And so, the World's Fair round toothpick, Chief, has a character all of its own. He types frantically, madly, and forever it's enshrined on the back of a box. Have you ever thought about those boxes? No, the stuff that's on the back of the cream of wheat package. The stuff that's on the side of the Dial soap wrapper. The stuff that's that writing, you know, that's on the can of Crestone you buy, you know, the stuff you put in your radiator. Have you thought of somebody sitting down writing that? The guy's really a writer. He goes home and he's writing. He's been writing and he's a writer. But almost every writer I've known, even guys who write recipes on the back of frozen fudge boxes, almost every one of these guys had at one time an idea he was going to write a novel. Yeah. Everybody who's ever put three words together, big sign says, ice cold, beer. He thought of himself as a writer. I did, you know. And even in some dark soul of the night, he still thinks of himself as a writer. He sees, can you imagine a guy collecting his works? He's got all these boxes, and he's got all these cartons, and once in a while when friends come over, he says, have you read my latest? It's on the cream of wheat box. Oh, did you see? Rich, creamy, delicious, sticks to the ribs, a warming breakfast. How do you like that? A warming breakfast sticks to the ribs. You know, it's the beat and the rhythm. It's a little Thomas Wolfe there. Cries out for the rich, deep Americana of an American breakfast that sings from the deep, wild, flat plain lands where the rice grows. And where, oh, sure. The writer is everywhere. Now, look, you don't want me to tell you the story about the hamburger, do you? Everybody's saying, tell us the story. All right, I'll tell you. This is something that I have not wanted to admit to for a long time because, well, let's face it. What is more American than a hamburger? In fact, it's even found its way. It's been enshrined in pop art. And the American hamburger is known all over the world. In fact, you know, the hamburger is more American, really, than the hot dog. That you see hot dogs all over. Germany has more hot dogs than we have, for crying out. This is, the Frankfurter. You know, the Frankfurter, when you read Frankfurter, that means a sausage made in Frankfurt. That the Frankfurter that we have here is a classic German sausage. And so when you say hot dog is an American dish, forget it. That's not an American thing. And the hamburger, however, is. And you never want to admit somehow that you got off the course somewhere in Americanism. Well, do you know, and I hate to admit this, I don't want to tell this out loud, but I must have been at least 18 or 19 before I could actually eat and enjoy a hamburger. And it took me at least 2 years after I again tried a hamburger. It took me at least 2 years before I could really eat them without any qualm, a funny feeling deep down inside in the pit of the stomach. I wonder how many of you have ever had something physical that happens to you that results in a traumatic experience. Now, a traumatic experience, now, when a lot of people use that word wrong. You know, they'll say a traumatic experience is anything exciting that happened to them, or sickening, or anything that was, a big thing that happened to them. But a true trauma, look the word up, that's a good word, trauma. It's even the word is a very descriptive word, trauma. Say it to yourself, trauma. Yeah, trauma. That's a word. It's kind of it's a word that shudders. You know, a traumatic experience is an experience that is the equivalent, if you're going to take an equivalent in nature, it's the equivalent to a genuine earthquake. I mean, it goes to the core of things. And you have a traumatic experience, and it goes all the way down into your foundations, the little rocks that your soul is built out of, the little mortar and the little bricks that your psyche is made from. When you have a traumatic experience, little cracks appear in it. Runs right down the side. And you don't fix it that quickly. No, it's like you bent the frame in your car or something. It's always out of line. It's out of tilt. It's out of kilter. Well, I had a traumatic experience that involved hamburgers. That I know I've never told this on the air. Well, let me tell you the story. I have never told this because it's something that has become folklore and legend in my family. It's a legendary thing. It's the time Jeannie, which is what I was known by a certain wing of my family, the time Jeannie blew up like a Christmas turkey. Have you ever seen turkeys in the window of stores? You know, just before a big holiday, like geese and turkeys, and they blow them up. Have you seen that in the windows of butcher shops? And the turkey gets round and hard like a drum, big and fat. I'm not talking about the frozen food department. They're big. Boo! They blow them up somehow. Well, let me tell you. It was late in the fall of the year. It was just about the time when the wind was getting a little nippy and edgy, and there was a kind of cold breeze blowing through the trees. This is the time when the soul is wide open. It's the time that almost every Sherlock Holmes story opens. You know, Sherlock Holmes hardly ever opens, the real Holmes stories hardly ever open on bright sunny days. Oh no, the wind was beating against the digs on 221 Baker Street. And the howling gales of November were beginning to rattle the tiles of the roof. And they could hear outside suddenly as the fire is roaring in the fireplace. And Holmes is sitting slumped over in his old chair, his chin on his chest. And Dr. Watson is leafing through a volume of forgotten medical lore. They could hear the ominous... the sound of a carriage stopping in front of that winter-bound digs at 221 Baker Street. Holmes looks up, his thin, slitted eyes, lidded like a pair of serpent's eyes. Watson, quick, are you armed? Do you have your revolver, Watson? We are being visited by Professor Moriarty. The sound of a neighing horse. Yes, well, it's that kind of weather that you're open for traumas. And it seemed that One of the Ukrainian-American clubs in our area, we had a million Ukrainian-American clubs, Polish-American clubs, there were Czechoslovakian-American clubs, there were Swedish-American clubs, there were Irish-American clubs, there were Somaliland-American clubs, there were Nome-American clubs, there were Antarctica-American clubs. We had all kinds of clubs all around the area where I grew and festered. On the northern fringes of Indiana, laying there like a great, fast, pool table, locked in the grip of the dunes and the lakes and the wind and the howling winter breezes. Well, there it is. The Ukrainian American Club was having a big winter picnic. Have you ever been to a winter picnic? Well, they had them out there. And they had it in the forest preserve. And they had big fires, big roaring fires, and everyone wore their fur hats with the earmuffs. And I was a kid, and I was busting in with Flick and Bruner and Schwartz. We were freeloaders. Whenever anything happened down at the old forest preserve, Flick and Schwartz and Bruner and I would get on our bikes and pretend we're Ukrainians. Or we would pretend we were Croatians. Or we would pretend we were Ku Klux Klanners or whatever it is that was having its big picnic down there. We would go in, yeah, actually, because they always have free food, you know. We're knocking it down. There were a lot of little chicks and everything around there. Well, the Ukrainian Americans, believe it or not, at their gigantic bash, their big winter clam bake there, and they were dancing and hollering and doing the shottish or whatever it is the Ukrainians do, and the guys were playing the accordions and the ladies were jumping around. You could see their breath flying. You could smell them. Oh, boy, it was wild. They had a fantastic charcoal pit that must have been 45 feet across with spits going across it, and they were making hamburgers with hot buns, with ketchup, with big, thick slices of ice-cold Bermuda onions, and with gigantic gobboons full of mustard. Well, good Lord. I mean, I was about 10. Now, I little knowing that I was about to embark on a genuine traumatic experience, and I'm not embellishing this, I am not inventing this. Schwartz and Flick and Bruner and I got into line for the hamburgers. We had on our sheepskin coats. We looked like all the Ukrainian kids. You know, there were thousands of them. And I just kept hollering words like, Tashi, Karabara, Inam Turam, you know, stuff like that. And we just go through the line. And there was this great big Ukrainian with his wife and about 17 other Ukrainians. But he's at the head of the line. And he is handing out the hamburgers on a paper plate. And he'd lay that hamburger down. And he would just reach down into a great big tub he had and put a gigantic handful of potato chips on. Just potato chips. Well, the instant we get our hamburger, we go darting off behind the trees and the bushes. And we'd, you know, stuffing it in our mouth because we wanted to get back in the line real quick. See, before they ran out. Oh, they were fantastic hamburgers. Into the gullet because, ooh, the mustard and the ketchup and the onion. Oh, just great. Back at the end of the line. And we're hollering, Adam Turam Tashik, Atapolamajo, we're yelling. Well, we're going through the line, and the Ukrainian gives me another hamburger. Well, conservatively estimated at this point, I had approximately 17 hamburgers. Each one of which tipped the scales of it about 3/4 of a pound. Big charcoal hamburgers. Well, I went on binge. You know, it's free. You know that nuttiness when there's something free, you've got to eat it all. Believe me, if the state of Ohio was being offered free, if you were going to eat it, I would start at Toledo and I wouldn't stop until I hit Cincinnati if it was free. Well, it's that kind of thing. So I'm eating the hamburgers. Back I go, and each hamburger, of course, came with about a half a pound of potato chips, and about 17 quarts of ketchup. So I go through the line. I go back, go through the line, go back and go. And, of course, all the rest of these guys were great big, you know, steel workers, big bohunk, big Ukrainian steel workers. They could put away 45 hamburgers and nobody's saying any of the difference. All the while the music, you know, they play that. Have you ever heard the Ukrainians dancing? They start hammering, you know, with the beer steins. Oh, you know, it goes on and on and on, the whole scene. And I am eating hamburgers from about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I would say to roughly 9:30 at night. Non-stop. Well, the time is up now. They're beginning to, you know, how they begin to fade into the darkness. You could hear the cars starting. The embers are burning down, and Schwartz and Flick and Bruner and I are clearing out the last of the potato chips. We have done away with a ton and a half of them. And now I am home. I am feeling great. Just feeling absolutely magnificent. I have scored in the free kid world. I have drunk 17 bottles of knee-high orange, which they were giving away free to the kids. And I am now in my sack. and I am sleeping under, we had this quilt, see, I'm under the quilt, I'm lying there, feeling good and warm, and suddenly, I began to swell. I'm telling you the God's honest truth, I'm swelling. I'm telling you the truth, I'm swelling out from under my pajamas. I'm beginning to bulge. And it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I can feel it, and it's getting tighter. It's like I'm going to blow up. Actually blow up, and I could feel something bubbling and something pushing up some from inside. My head was being stretched on my neck. It was coming out. My feet were going down at the bottom, and began to bulge up and up. It's now about 9:30, quarter to 10. It's now 10 o'clock. It's 10:15. It's 11. I can hear my mother and father talking quietly out in the living room, and I am bulging. I'm bulging. It's getting bigger and bigger. And then the first wave of insane, unbelievable pain hit me. A gigantic shuddering pain. Oh, what a pain. I lay there. And then it began to grow again. Higher and higher and higher. And my mother says, "What's the matter, Jeannie?" She came in and pulled back the covers. And she said, "You're blown up like a turkey. Like a turkey." And it grew higher and higher until there was a thin scream of gas coming out of both ears. Oh! I was ready to blow my overload relay. And all night long it got worse and worse until suddenly it's 5 o'clock in the morning. I could see nothing but great red flashes before my mother's got cold cloths on my head. My father's massaging my feet. My kid brother is sleeping and crying alternately under the bed. And I'm going, oh, oh, oh. And finally at 5:30 in the morning, boom! Ah! Wah! 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 17 quarts of moderately dissolved hamburgers came flying out. I lay there. I was blown up like a Christmas turkey. It was like I had a safety valve on the side and it was stuck. Oh, and from that day on, every time I saw a hamburger, I could taste a funny acid taste in the air. A strange feeling of my nose itched. You know how the stuff comes out of your nose and out of your ears and everything else? And it wasn't until I was 18 years old that I could even look a hamburger in the face.
And so, to the strains of the world's worst theme music, so ends Gene Shepherd's story of The Great Hamburger Blow-Up, originally broadcast in April 1965. The original recording, which I have shortened, is courtesy of Radio Veronica, by way of radioforall.net. There you can find an archive of our own show, too. And you'll find another one at our own website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum, and do come back again next week. Till then.